at my duster's pocket. The flap covering it flew up, and the slender book in its paper bag started sliding out. "Ack!" I managed, which was all the repartee I was up for at the moment. I rolled and trapped the book between my body and the ground. Komori extended her hand again, and more forcefully. I slid 2 feet over the concrete until I braced a boot against an uneven joint in the sidewalk and saw movement behind the 2 figures. "Game over," I said. "Stop it."
"Or what?"
Cowell demanded. "Ever see Wolfen?" I spat. Wolves appeared, just freaking appeared out of the Chicago night. Big wolves. Refugees from a previous epoch. Huge, strong-looking beasts with white fangs and savage eyes. One was crouched on the wrecked Buick within an easy leap of Cowell, bright eyes fastened on him. Another had appeared behind Komori, and a third leapt lightly down from a fire escape, landing in the soundless crouch in front of her. One appeared on either side of me, and snarls bubbled out of the night. More lights were coming on. A siren wailed in the night. "What big teeth they have," I said. "You want to keep going until the cops show up? I'm game." There wasn't even a pause for the 2 cloaked figures to look significantly at each other. Komori glided to Cowell's side. Cowell gave me a look that I felt, even if I couldn't see his face, and he growled,
"This isn't..."
"Oh, shut up," I said. "You lost. Go." Cowell's fingers formed into a rigid claw, and he snarled a word I couldn't quite hear, slashing at the air. There was a surge of power, darker this time, somehow more nebulous. The air around them blurred. There was the sudden scent of mildew and lightless waters, a sighing sound, and as quickly as that, they were simply gone. "Billy," I said a second later, angry, "what the hell are you doing? Those people could have killed you." The wolf crouching on the wrecked car looked at me and dropped its mouth open into a lolling grin. It leapt over the broken glass to land beside me, shimmered, and a second later the wolf was gone, replaced by a naked man crouching beside me. Billy was a little shorter than average and had more muscle than a Bowflex commercial. Medium brown hair, matching eyes, and he wore a short beard now that made him look a lot older than when I first met him years ago. Of course, he was older than when I'd met him years ago. "This is my neighborhood," he said quietly. "Can't afford to let anyone make me look bad here." He moved with quick efficiency, getting a shoulder under one of mine and hauling me to my feet by main strength. "How bad are you hurt?" "Bruises," I said. The world spun a little as he hauled me up, and I wasn't sure I could have stood on my own. "Little wobbly, out of breath." "Cops will be here in about 70 seconds, he said, like someone who knew. "Come on, George is in the car at the other end of this alley." "No," I said. "Look, just get me to my car. I can't be..." I couldn't be seen with him. If Mavra was watching me or having me tailed, it might mean that she would release the dirt she had on Murphy. But I damn sure couldn't just explain everything to him. Billy wasn't the sort to stand by when he saw a friend in trouble. And I was damned lucky he wasn't. I hadn't had much left in me but some hot air when Cowell had stood up again. "No time," Billy said. "Look, we'll get you back here after things calm down later." "Christ, Harry, you crushed that car like a beer can. I didn't know you were that strong." "Me neither," I said. I couldn't get to my car on my own. I couldn't afford to be seen with Billy and the Alphas. But I couldn't allow myself to get detained or thrown into jail either. Never mind that if Cowell and his sidekick had found me, there might be other interested parties after me, too. If I kept showing my face on the streets, someone would tear it off for me. I had to go with Billy. I would cut things as short as I could. I didn't want them involved in this business any more than they already were anyway, as much to protect them as Murphy. Damn it, Mavra would just have to show some freaking understanding. Maybe if I said please. Yeah, right. I might already have blown it and doomed Murphy, but I didn't have much choice. I leaned on Billy the werewolf and did the best I could to hobble along with him down the alley and off the street. Chapter 9. Billy probably could have picked me up and carried me at a flat run if he needed to, but we had to cross only about 50 yards of alley and darkened street before an expensive SUV, its lights out, cut over to the curb and made a swift stop in front of us.
Quick, I said, still panting, to the Wolfmobile.
Billy helped me into the back seat, followed me in, and before the door was even shut, the SUV began accelerating smoothly and calmly from the scene. The interior smelled like new car-scented air freshener and fast food.
What happened? Asked the driver.
She was a willowy young woman about Billy's age, somewhere around 6 feet tall. Her brown hair was pulled into a severe braid, and she wore jeans and a denim jacket.
Hello, Harry.
Evening, Georgia,
I replied, slumping back against the headrest.
Are you all right?
Nothing a nice long nap won't fix.
He was attacked, Billy supplied, answering the first question. He tugged sweats and a t-shirt out of an open gym bag and hopped into them with practiced motions.
The vampires again? Georgia asked.
She turned on the headlights and joined other traffic. Reflected streetlights gleamed off the diamond engagement ring on her left hand.
I thought the Reds were staying out of town.
Not vampires, I said. My eyelids started increasing their mass, and I decided not to argue with them. New friends. I think they must have been other wizards, Billy said quietly. Big black cloaks and hoods. I couldn't see their faces.
What set the police off? She asked.
Harry flipped a car over on top of one of them. I heard Georgia suck in her breath through her teeth.
Yeah, and I'm the one who lost the fight, I muttered. Barely even rattled his cage.
My God, Georgia said. Is everyone all right?
Yeah, I replied. The bad guys got away. If the Alphas hadn't come along when they did, I'm not sure I would have.
Everyone else scattered, and they'll meet us back at the apartment, Billy said.
Who were those guys?
I can't tell you that, I said. There was an empty second, and then Billy's voice turned cautious.
Why? Is it some kind of secret need-to-know wizard thing?
No. I just have no freaking clue who it was.
Oh. What do they want? Billy asked. I only showed up at the end.
I picked up a rare book at Box. Apparently they wanted it. I could have sworn I heard his brow furrow.
Is it valuable?
Something and it must be, I answered.
I fumbled at my pocket and drew out the book to make sure it was still there. The slender volume looked innocent enough, and at least it wouldn't take too long to read through.
I appreciate the assist, but I can't stay.
Sure, sure, Billy said. What can we do to help?
Don't take me to your apartment, for one, I said. Somewhere you don't go as much.
Why not? Billy asked.
Please, man, just do it. And let me think for a minute, I said, and closed my eyes again. I tried to work out how best to keep the Alphas from getting involved in this business, but my weary, aching body betrayed me. I dropped into a sudden darkness, too black and silent to allow for any dreams.
When I jerked awake, my neck was aching from being bent forward, my chin on my chest. We weren't driving anymore, and I was alone in the SUV. The hollow weariness had abated significantly, and I didn't feel any trembling in my limbs. I couldn't have been out for very long, but even a little sleep can do wonders sometimes. I got out and found myself in a garage, big enough to house half a dozen cars, though the SUV and a shiny black Mercury were the only two vehicles in it. I recognized the place, George's parents' house, an upper-end place on the north side of town. The Alphas had brought me here once before, when they helped rescue me from the lair of a gang of psychotic lycanthropes. Susan had been with me. I shook my head, took up my staff and the little book, and walked toward the door to the house. I paused just before I opened it and heard voices speaking in quiet tones. I closed my eyes and focused on my sense of hearing, head tilted to one side, and the sound of the voices became clear and distinct enough for me to understand. It's a useful skill, listening, though I couldn't tell you exactly how to do it. There was the sound of a phone being returned to its cradle.
They're all fine, Billy said.
Good, Georgia replied. Something's going on. Did you see his face?
He looked tired, Billy said.
He looked more than just tired. He's afraid.
Maybe,
Billy said, after a second of hesitation. So what if he is?
So how bad must things be if he's afraid? Georgia asked.
And there's more. Billy exhaled.
His hand.
You saw it then?
Yeah, after he nodded off.
He's not supposed to have any movement in it, she said, her voice growing more worried. You've seen him on gaming nights. He can barely cup his fingers to hold chips. I heard the wood of his staff creaking under them tonight. I thought he would crush it.
I blinked at that news and looked down at my gloved hand. I tried to wiggle my fingers. They sort of twitched.
He's been a little different since he got burned, Billy said.
It's been longer than that, Georgia said. It's been since the year before. Remember when he showed up to gaming with all those bandages under his sweater? He never would talk about what happened. It was a week after that murder at the docks and that big terrorist scare at the airport. It's been since then. He's been distant. More all the time.
You think he had something to do with that murder? Billy asked.
Of course not, Georgia said.
But I think he might have been working on a case and gotten involved with the victim in some way. You know how he is. He probably blames himself for her death.
I swallowed and tried not to think of a pretty, dark-haired woman bleeding to death while the hold of her boat slowly filled with water. She'd made enough bad choices to get herself into trouble, but I hadn't been able to protect her from the creature that had taken her life.
If he's in trouble, we're going to help him, Billy said.
Yes, Georgia replied. But think about this, Billy. Getting involved might not be the best way to do it.
What do you mean?
I mean that he didn't want us to take him to the apartment, Georgia said.
Do you know why?
No, I don't. Neither do you.
She made a disgusted sound.
Billy, he's afraid the apartment is being watched.
By who?
By what? Georgia said. We haven't seen or heard or scented anything. If there's magic at work here, it could be more than we know how to handle.
So what are you saying? Billy said. That we should just abandon him if he's in trouble?
No, she sighed. But Billy, you saw what he was capable of doing. We saw him mow through an army at the ferry battleground, and you tell me tonight that he flipped a car onto one of these other wizards, and that the man blew it off. I don't think we're weak, but running off ghouls and trolls and the occasional vampire is one thing. Mixing it up with wizards is something else. You've seen what kind of power they have.
I'm not afraid, Billy said.
Then you're stupid, Georgia replied, her voice blunt but not cruel. Harry isn't what he used to be. He's been hurt. And I don't care what he says. His injured hand bothers him more than he lets on. He doesn't need any more handicaps.
You want to just leave him alone? Billy asked.
I don't want to weigh him down. You know him. He'll protect other people before he takes care of himself. If he's operating so far out of our league, we might not be anything but a distraction to him. We have to understand our limits.
There was a long silence.
I don't care, Billy said then. I'm not just going to stand by if he's in trouble. All I want, Georgia said, is for you to listen to him. If he doesn't want our support, or if he thinks it's too dangerous for us to be involved, we have to trust that he knows what he's doing. He knows things that we don't. He's trusted us before, and he's never led us wrong. Just promise me that you'll return the compliment.
I can't just turn away, Billy said.
I wouldn't want you to, Georgia said. But sometimes you think with your fangs and not with your head, Will.
There was the soft sound of a kiss.
I love you. We'll help him however we can. I just wanted you to consider the idea that he might not need us for violence.
Billy took a couple of heavy steps. One of the kitchen chairs creaked.
I don't know what else we can do.
Well, Georgia said. She opened the fridge. What about these masked wizard types? Did you get close enough to scent them?
I tried, Billy said. And I was closest to them, but...
But?
I couldn't get a scent. Harry did something. He flipped the car over. There was a flash of red light, and after that all I could smell was...
I heard Georgia take a couple of steps, maybe to touch him.
What did you smell?
Sulfur, Billy said, his voice a little weak. I smelled brimstone. There was silence.
What does it mean? Georgia asked.
That I'm worried about him, Billy said. You should have seen the look on his face, the rage. I've never seen anyone look that angry.
You think he's...
what?
Unstable? Georgia asked.
You're the psych grad, Billy said. What do you think? I put my hand on the door. I hesitated for just a second and then pushed it open. Billy and Georgia both sat in a rather roomy kitchen at a small table with two bottles of beer set open but untouched on the table. They blinked and straightened, staring up at me in surprise.
What do you think? I asked Georgia quietly. I'd like to know, too.
Harry, Georgia said, I'm just a grad student. I went to the fridge and got myself a cold beer. It was an American brand, but I've got no palate in any case. I like my beer cold. I twisted the cap off, then walked over to the table and sat down with them.
I'm not looking for a therapist. You're a friend. Both of you are. I swigged beer. Tell me what you think.
Georgia and Billy traded a look, and Billy nodded.
Harry, Georgia said, I think you need to talk to someone. I don't think it's important who it is, but you have a lot of pressures on you, and if you don't find some way to let them out, you're going to hurt yourself.
Billy said, people talk to their friends, man. No one can do everything alone. You work through it together. I sipped some more beer. Georgia and Billy did, too. We sat in silence for maybe 4 or 5 minutes. Then I said, about 2 years ago, I exposed myself to a demonic influence, a creature called Lashiel, a fallen angel, the kind of being that turns people into real monsters. Georgia watched me, her eyes focused intently on my face.
Why did you do that?
It was in a silver coin, I said. Whoever touched it would have been exposed. There was a child who had no idea what it was. I didn't think. I just slapped my hand over it before the child could pick it up.
Georgia nodded. What happened?
I took measures to contain it, I said. I did everything I could think of, and for a while I thought I'd been successful. I sipped more beer. Then, last year, I realized that my magic was being augmented by a demonic energy called Hellfire. That's what you smell tonight, Billy, when I flipped the car.
Why do you use it? Billy asked.
I shook my head.
It isn't my choice. It just happens.
Georgia frowned.
I'm not an expert on magic, Harry, but from what I've learned, that kind of power doesn't come for free.
No, it doesn't.
Then what was the price? She asked.
I drew in a deep breath. Then I started peeling the leather glove off my scarred hand.
I wondered that too, I said.
I slid the glove off and turned my hand over. The scarring was the worst on the insides of my fingers and over my palm. It looked more like melted wax than human flesh, all white with flares of blue where some of the veins still survived, all except for the exact center of my palm. There, three lines of pink, healthy flesh formed a sigil vaguely suggestive of an hourglass.
I found this there when I got burned, I said. It's an ancient script. It's the symbol for the name of Lashiel.
Georgia drew in a slow breath and said,
oh.
Billy looked back and forth between us.
Oh? What oh?
Georgia gave me a be patient look and turned to Billy.
It's a demon mark, like a brand, yes?
She looked at me for confirmation. I nodded.
He's worried that this demon, Lashiel, might be exerting some kind of control on him in ways that he cannot detect.
Right, I said. Everything I know tells me that I should be cut off from Lashiel, that I should be safe. But the power is still there somehow.
And if the demon is influencing my thoughts, pulling my strings, I might not even be able to feel it happening.
Georgia frowned. Do you believe that to be a probability?
It's too dangerous to assume anything else, I said. I held up a hand. That's not hubris. It's just a fact. I have power. If I use it unwisely or recklessly, people could get hurt. They could die. And if Lashiel is somehow influencing me, who knows what could happen? Billy finished, his tone sober.
Yeah.
Damn, Billy said. We all took a sip of beer. I'm worried, I said. I haven't been able to find any answers. I've gone through spell after spell. Rites, ceremonies. I've tried everything. It won't go away.
Jesus, Billy breathed. An influence like this is detectable and against the laws of magic. If the wardens found out and pushed a trial on me, it might be enough to get me executed. And if I get near the Knight of the Cross I told you about, he'll be able to feel it on me. I don't know how he'd react, what he would think. I swallowed. I'm scared. Georgia touched my arm briefly, then said,
You shouldn't be so hard on yourself, Harry. I know you well enough to know that you would never want that kind of power, much less abuse it.
If some part of me didn't want it, I asked, why didn't I pick up the kid instead of Lashiel's coin? A heavy silence settled over the kitchen. You've been friends to me, stuck it out by me when times were rough, I said a moment later. You've made me welcome in your home, in your life. You're good people. I'm sorry I haven't been more open with you.
Is that what tonight was about? Billy asked. The demon?
No, I said. Tonight was different. And I can't tell you about it.
If you're trying to protect us, Billy began.
I'm not protecting you, I said. I'm protecting someone else. If I'm seen with you, it could get them badly hurt, maybe even killed.
I don't understand. I want to help, Billy said.
Georgia put her hand over Billy's. He glanced at her, flushed, and then closed his mouth. I nodded and finished the beer. I need you to trust me for a little while. I'm sorry, but the faster I'm out of here, the better.
How can we help? Georgia asked.
Just knowing that you want to is a help, I told her. But that's almost the only thing you can do, for now, at least.
Almost the only thing?
I nodded. If I could get something to eat, and maybe a ride back to my car, I'd be obliged.
We can do that, Billy said.
Thank you, I said.
Chapter 10.
I raided the refrigerator and divested it of a small plate of cold cuts while Billy made a call to his apartment. Moments later, one of the other alphas called back, confirming that the furor around Bach-ordered books had begun to die down.
Only one patrol car still there, Billy reported, plus the guys with the wrecker.
We shouldn't wait any longer, I said. With cops around, any neighborhood monsters will lie low for a while to be careful. I want to be back there and gone before they get moving again.
Eat in the car, Georgia suggested, and we all piled back into her SUV.
Georgia parked on the curb behind the Beetle and let me out. I had my keys in my hand, ready to get in and get gone. But when I saw the car, I stopped. Someone had smashed out the remaining windows in the car. Glass littered the street and the car's interior. Parts of the windshield were missing, and the rest clung together in a mass of fracture lines that made the whole mess opaque. The back window had already been broken when I used my force ring on that zombie earlier in the evening. The doors and the hood were dented in dozens of places, and the door handles had been entirely smashed off. The tires sagged limply, and I could see long, neat slashes in them without difficulty. I approached the car slowly. The wooden handle of a Louisville Slugger baseball bat protruded from the gaping driver's side window, the cardboard tag from the store still dangling from its string. Billy leaned out the SUV window and let out a low whistle.
Wow.
But on the upside, I said, now all the windows match.
What a mess, Georgia said.
I went around to the front of the car and opened the trunk. It hadn't been tampered with. My sawed-off shotgun was still in the back seat. Billy and Georgia got out and walked over to me.
Gang? Georgia asked.
Gang wouldn't have left the gun, I said.
The guys in the hoods?
Billy guessed. Didn't strike me as the baseball bat type. I reached in and picked up the bat with just my forefinger and thumb near the middle, where it wouldn't mar any fingerprints left on it. I showed it to them. Cowell would have used his magic to smash the car up, not a club. I walked around to the back of the car and frowned down at the engine. It looked intact. I leaned in the window and tried my key. The engine turned over without any trouble.
Huh, Billy said. Who completely ruins a car but doesn't touch the engine?
Someone sending me a message, I said. Billy pursed his lips.
What does it say?
That I need to rent a car, apparently, I said. I shook my head. I don't have time for this. Billy and Georgia traded a look, and Georgia nodded. She came over to me, took my car keys where I held them in my cupped left hand, and replaced them with her own.
Oh, hell no, I said. Don't do that.
It's not a big deal, she told me. Look, you still take your car to Mike's garage, right?
Well, yeah, but...
But nothing, Billy said. We're only a couple of blocks from the apartment. We'll get your car towed to Mike's. Georgia nodded firmly. Just bring back the SUV whenever the Beetle is ready.
I thought it over. Seeing my car torn up was actually a hell of a lot more distressing than I had thought it would be. It was only a machine. But it was my machine. Some part of me felt furious that someone had done this to my ride.
My first instinct was to refuse their offer, get the Beetle to the shop, and use cabs until then. But that was the anger talking. I forced myself to apply my brain to it, and figured that, given how much running around I might need to do in the near future, I couldn't afford it. I couldn't afford the time that public transportation would cost me either, assuming I could use it at all. Damn, but I hate to swallow my pride.
It's a new car. Something will blow out.
It's still under warranty, Georgia said.
Billy gave me a thumbs up. Good hunting, Harry. Whatever you're after. I nodded back to him and said, thanks.
I got into the SUV and headed out to speak to the only person in Chicago who knew as much about magic and death as I did. Mortimer Lindquist had done pretty well for himself over the past couple of years, and he'd moved out of the little California import stucco ranch house he'd been in the last time I'd gone to visit him. Now he was working out of a converted duplex in Bucktown. Mort leased both halves of the duplex and ran his business on one side, with his home on the other. There were no cars in the business driveway, though he mostly operated at night. He must have already wrapped up for the evening. He had abandoned the faux Gothic decor that had previously graced his place of business, which was a hopeful sign. I needed the help of someone with real skill, not a charlatan with a batch of gimmicks. I parked the SUV in the business driveway, mowing down a patch of yellow pansies as I did. I wasn't used to driving something that big. The Beetle might be small and slow, but at least I knew exactly where its tires were going to go. The lights were all out. I availed myself of the brass knocker hung on the residential door. 15 minutes later, a bleary-looking little man answered. He was short, 20 or 30 pounds overweight, and had given up trying to conceal his receding hairline in favor of shaving his scalp completely bald. He was wrapped in a thick maroon bathrobe and wore gray slippers on his feet.
"It's 3 o'clock in the morning," Mort complained. "What the hell do you..."
He saw my face, and his eyes widened in panic. He hurried to shut the door. I stabbed my oak staff into the doorway and stopped him from closing it.
"Hi, Mort. Got a minute?" "Go away, Dresden," the little man said. "Whatever it is you want, I don't have it."
I leaned on my staff and put on an affable smile.
"Mort, after all we've been through together, I can't believe you'd speak to me like that."
Mort gestured furiously at a pale scar on his scalp.
"The last time I had a conversation with you, I wound up with a concussion and 15 stitches in my head."
"I need your help," I said.
"Ha!" Mort said. "Thank you, but no. You might as well ask me to paint a target on my chest."
He kicked at my staff, but not very hard. Those slippers wouldn't have protected his foot very well.
"Get out before something sees you here."
"Can't do that, Mort," I said. "There's black magic afoot.
You know that, don't you? The little man stared at me in silence for a moment. Then he said,
Why do you think I want you gone? I don't want to be seen with you. I'm not involved.
You are now, I said. I kept smiling, but all I really wanted to do was throw a jab at his nose. I guess my feelings must have leaked through into my expression, because Mort took one look at my face and blanched. People are in trouble. I'm helping them. Now, open this damn door and help me, or I swear to God I am going to come camp out on your lawn in my sleeping bag. Mort's eyes widened, and he looked around outside the house, nervous energy making his eyes flick back and forth rapidly.
You son of a bitch, he said.
Believe it. He opened the door. I stepped inside, and he shut it behind me, snapping several locks closed. The interior of the house was clean, businesslike. The entry hall had been converted into a small waiting room, and beyond it lay the remainder of the first floor, a richly colored room lined with candles and sconces, now unlit, featuring a large table of dark polished wood surrounded by matching hand-carved chairs. Mort stalked into his séance room, picked up a box of kitchen matches, and started lighting a few candles.
Well, he asked, going to show me how all-powerful you are? Call up a gale in my study? Maybe slam a few doors for dramatic effect?
Would you like me to? He threw the matches down on the table and took a seat at its head.
Maybe I haven't been clear with you, Dresden, Mort said. I'm not a wizard. I'm not with the council. I have no interest in attracting their attention or that of their enemies. I am not a participant in your war with the vampires. I like my blood where it is.
This isn't about the vampires, I said. Mort frowned.
No? Are things dying down then?
I grimaced and took a seat a few chairs down. There was a nasty fight in Mexico City 3 weeks ago, and the wardens bloodied the Red Court's nose pretty well. Seems to have thrown a wrench in their plans for some reason.
Getting ready to hit back, Mort said.
Everyone figures that, I said. We just don't know where or when. Mort exhaled and leaned his forehead on the heel of one hand.
Did you know I found someone they'd killed a couple of years ago? Young boy, maybe 10 years old.
A ghost? I asked. Mort nodded.
Little guy had no idea what was going on. He didn't even know he was dead. They cut his throat with a razor blade. You could barely see the mark unless he turned to look over his right shoulder.
That's what they do, I said.
How can you see things like that and not want to fight them? Bad things happen to people, Dresden, Mort said. I'm sorry as hell about it, but I'm not you. I don't have the power to change it.
Like hell you don't, I said. You're an ectomancer, one of the strongest I've met. You've got access to all kinds of information. You could do a lot of good.
Information doesn't stop fangs, Dresden. If I start using what I know against them, I'd be a threat. 5 minutes after I get involved, I'll be the one with his throat cut.
Better them than you, huh? He looked up and spread his hands.
I am what I am, Dresden. A coward. I don't apologize for it.
He folded his fingers and regarded me soberly.
What's the fastest way for me to get you away from my home and out of my life?
I leaned my staff against the table and slouched into my chair.
What do you know about what's been happening in town lately?
Black magic? Mort asked.
Not much. I've had nightmares, which is unusual. The dead have been nervous for several days. It's been difficult to get them to answer a summons, even with Halloween coming up.
Has that happened before? I asked.
Not on this scale, Mort said. I've asked, but they won't explain to me why they're afraid. In my experience, it's one way that spiritual entities react to the presence of dark powers.
I nodded, frowning.
It's necromancy, I said. You ever heard about a guy named Kemmler?
Mort's eyes widened.
Oh, God. His disciples?
I think so, I said. A lot of them. Mort's face turned a little green.
That explains why they're so afraid.
Why? He waved a hand.
The dead are terrified of whatever is moving around out there. Necromancers can enslave them, control them, even destroy them.
So they can feel their power? I asked.
Absolutely.
Good, I said. I was counting on that. Mort frowned and arched an eyebrow. I'm not sure how many of them are in town, I said. I need to know where they are, or at least how many of them are here. I want you to ask the dead to help me locate them.
He lifted both hands.
They won't. I'll tell you that for certain. You couldn't get a ghost to willingly appear within screaming distance of a necromancer.
Come on, Mort, don't start holding out on me.
I'm not,
he said, and held up two fingers in a scout's hand signal.
My pledge of honor upon it.
I exhaled, frustrated. What about residual magic?
What do you mean?
Whenever these necromancers work with dark magic, it leaves a kind of stain or footprint. I can sense it if I get close enough.
So why don't you do it?
It's a big town, I said. And whatever these lunatics are up to, it's got to happen by midnight Halloween. I don't have time to walk a grid hoping to get close.
And you think the dead will?
I think the dead can move through walls and the floor, and that there are a whole lot more of them than there are of me, I said. If you ask them, they might do it.
They might attract attention to themselves, you mean, Mort said.
No, they may be dead, but that doesn't mean they can't get hurt. I won't risk that for council infighting. I blinked for a second. A few years ago, Mort had barely been able to crawl out of his bottle long enough to cold-read credulous idiots into believing he could speak to their dead loved ones. Even after he'd gotten his life together and begun to reclaim his atrophied talents, he had never displayed any particular indication that he wanted anything more than to turn a profit on his genuine skills rather than with fraud. Mort always looked out for number one. But not tonight. I recognized the quiet, steady light in his eyes. He was not going to be pushed on this issue. Maybe Mort wasn't willing to go to the wall for his fellow human beings, but apparently, with the dead, it was different. I hadn't expected the little ectomancer to grow a backbone, even if it was only a partial one. I weighed my options. I could always try to lean harder on Mort, but I was pretty sure that it wouldn't do me much good. I could try contacting the ghosts of Chicagoland myself, but while I knew the basic theory of ectomancy, I had no practical experience with it. I had no time to waste floundering around like a clueless newbie in an area of magic totally outside my practical experience. Mort, I said. Look, if you mean it, I'll respect that. I'll go right now. He frowned, his eyes wary.
But this isn't about wizard politics, I said. Kemmler's disciples have already killed at least one person here in town, and they're going to kill more.
He slumped a little in his chair and closed his eyes.
Bad things happen to people, Dresden. That's not my fault.
Please, I said. Mort, I have a friend involved in this. If I don't deal with these assholes, she's going to get hurt. He didn't open his eyes or answer me.
Damn it. I couldn't force him to help me. If he wasn't going to be moved, he wasn't going to be moved.
Thanks for nothing then, Mort, I told him. My voice sounded more tired than bitter. Keep on looking out for number one. I rose, picked up my staff, and walked toward the door.
I had it unlocked and half open when Mort said, What's her name?
I paused and inhaled slowly. It's Murphy, I said without turning around. Karen Murphy. There was a long silence.
Oh, Mort said then. You should have just said so. I'll ask them.
I looked over my shoulder. The ectomancer stood up and walked over to a low bureau. He withdrew several articles and started laying them out on the table. I shut the door and locked it again, then went back to the ectomancer. Mort unfolded a paper street map of Chicago and laid it flat on the table. Then he set candles at each of its corners and lit them. Finally, he poured red ink from a little vial into a perfume atomizer. After watching him for a moment, I asked, Why?
I knew her father, Mort said. I know her father.
She's a good person, I said.
That's what I hear.
He closed his eyes for a moment and took a deep breath.
Dresden, I need you to be quiet for a while. I can't afford any distraction.
All right, I said.
I'm going to ask them, Mort said. You won't hear me, but they will. I'll spray the ink into the air over the map, and they'll bring it down wherever they find one of your footprints.
You think it'll work? I asked. He shrugged.
Maybe, but I've never done this before.
He closed his eyes and added,
Shh!
I sat waiting and tried not to fidget. Mort was completely still for several minutes, and then his lips started moving. No sound came from them, except for the quiet sighs of breathing when he inhaled. He broke out into a sudden and heavy sweat, his bald head gleaming in the candlelight. The air suddenly vibrated against my face, and flashes of cold raced over my body at random. A second later, I became acutely conscious of another presence in the room, then another, and a third. Seconds after that, though I could see or hear no one, I became certain that the room was packed with people, and an accompanying sense of claustrophobia made me long to get outside into fresh air. It was definitely magic, but different from any I had felt before. I fought the trapped, panicked sensation and remained seated, still and quiet. Mort nodded sharply, picked up the atomizer, and sprayed a mist of red ink into the air over the map. I held my breath and leaned closer. The mist drifted down over the map, but instead of settling into an even spread, the fine droplets began to swirl into miniature vortexes like tiny, bloody tornadoes sweeping over the map. Scarlet circles formed at the base of the mini tornadoes until the whirling cones spiraled down into vertical lines, then vanished. Mort let out a grunt and slumped forward in his chair, gasping for breath. I stood up and examined the street map by candlelight.
Did it work?
Mort rasped. I think it did, I said. I put my finger beside one of the larger red circles. This is the Forensic Institute. One of them created a zombie there earlier tonight. Mort sat up and leaned forward over the map, his eyes glazed with fatigue. He pointed at another bloody dot.
That one? It's the Field Museum.
I traced my finger to another one.
This one is in a pretty tough neighborhood. I think it's an apartment building.
I moved on to the next.
A cemetery, and what the hell, at O'Hare?
Mort shook his head.
The ink's darker than the others. I think that means it's beneath the airport, in Undertown.
Uh-huh, I said. That makes sense.
Two more. An alley down by Burnham Park and a sidewalk on Wacker.
Six, Mort said.
Six, I agreed.
Six necromancers, like Gravain and Cowell. And only one of me. Hell's bells.
Chapter 11. I clipped my old iron mailbox with the front fender of the stupid SUV as I pulled into the driveway at my apartment. The box dented one corner of the vehicle's hood and toppled over with a heavy clang. I parked the SUV and shoved the pole the mailbox was mounted on back into the ground, but the impact had bent the pole. My mailbox leaned drunkenly to one side, but it stayed upright. Good enough for me. I gathered up my gear, including the sawed-off shotgun I'd removed from the Beetle, and got indoors in a hurry. I set things down and locked up my wards and the heavy steel door I'd had installed after a big bad demon had huffed and puffed and blown down the original. It wasn't until I had them all firmly secured that I'd let out a slow breath and started to relax. The living room was lit only by the embers of the fire and a few tiny flames. From the kitchen alcove, I heard the soft thumping sound of Mouse's tail wagging against the icebox. Thomas sat in the big, comfy recliner next to the fire, absently stroking Mister. My cat, curled up on Thomas's lap, watched me with heavy-lidded eyes.
Thomas, I said.
All quiet on the basement front, Thomas murmured.
Once Butters wound down, he just about dropped unconscious. I told him he could sleep in the bed.
Fine, I said. I took my copy of Earl King, lit a few candles on the end table,
and flopped down onto the couch. Thomas arched an eyebrow.
Oh, I said, sitting up. Sorry, didn't think. You probably want to sleep.
Not especially, he said. Someone should keep watch anyway.
You all right? I asked him.
I just don't feel like sleeping right now. You can have the couch.
I nodded and settled down again.
You want to talk?
If I did, I'd be talking. He went back to staring at the fire and stroking the cat. He was still upset, obviously, but I'd learned that it was pointless to start pushing Thomas, no matter how well-intentioned I might be. He'd dig in his heels from sheer obstinacy, and the conversation would get nowhere.
Thanks, I said, for looking out for Butters for me.
Thomas nodded. We fell into a relaxed silence, and I started reading the book. A while later, I fell asleep. I dreamed, almost immediately. Threatening trees, mostly evergreens, rose up around a small glade. In its center, a modest, neat campfire sparked and crackled. I could smell a lake somewhere nearby, moss and flowers and dead fish blending in with the scent of mildewed pine. The air was cold enough to make me shiver, and I hunched a little closer to the fire, but even so, I felt like my back was to a glacier. From somewhere overhead came the wild, honking screams of migrating geese under a crescent moon. I didn't recognize the place, but it somehow seemed perfectly familiar. A camping rig straddled the fire, holding a tin coffee mug and a suspended pot of what smelled like some kind of rich stew, maybe venison. My father sat across the fire from me. Malcolm Dresden was a tall, spare man with dark hair and steady blue eyes. His jeans were as heavily worn as his leather hiking boots, and I could see that he was wearing his favorite red and white flannel shirt under his fleece-lined hunting jacket. He leaned forward and stirred the pot, then took a sip from the spoon.
"Not bad," he said.
He picked up a couple of tin mugs from one of the stones surrounding the fire and grabbed the coffee pot by its wooden handle. He poured coffee into both cups, hung the coffee pot back over the fire, and offered me one of them.
"You warm enough?"
I accepted the mug and just stared at him for a moment. Maybe I had expected him to look exactly like I remembered, but he didn't. He looked so thin. He looked young, maybe even younger than me. And so very, very ordinary.
"You go deaf, son?" my father asked, grinning. "Or mute?"
I fumbled for words.
It's cold out here.
"It is that," he agreed. He pulled a couple of packs of powdered creamer from a knapsack and passed them over to me along with a couple of packs of sugar. We prepared the coffee in silence and sipped at it for a few moments. It filled me with an earthy, satisfying warmth that made the terrible chill along my spine more bearable.
"This is a nice change of pace from my usual dream," I said.
"How so?" my father asked.
"Fewer tentacles, fewer screams, less death."
Just then, out in the blackness beneath the trees, something let out an eerie, wailing, alien cry. I shivered, and my heart beat a little faster.
"The night is young," my father said dryly.
There was a rushing sound out in the woods, and I saw the tops of several trees swaying in succession as something, something big, moved among them. From tree to tree, the unseen threat moved, circling the little glade. I looked down and saw ripples on the surface of my coffee. My hand was trembling.
"What is that?" I asked.
"Beware the Jabberwock, my son," he said. He took a sip of his coffee and regarded the motion in the trees without fear. "You know what it is. You know what it wants."
I swallowed.
"The demon."
He nodded, blue eyes on mine.
"I don't suppose..."
"I'm fresh out of Vorpal swords," my father said.
He reached into the pack and tossed me a miniature candy bar. "The closest I can get is a Snickers snack."
"You call that a funny line?" I asked.
"Look who's talking."
"So," I said, "why haven't I dreamed about you before?"
Because I wasn't allowed to contact you before, my father said easily. Not until others had crossed the line.
Allowed? I asked. What others? What line?
He waved a hand. It isn't important. And we don't have much time here before it returns. I sighed and rubbed at my eyes. Okay, I'm done with the stupid nostalgia dream. Why don't you go back to wherever you came from and I'll have a nice soothing dream of going to work naked. He laughed. That's better. I know you're afraid, son. Afraid for your friends. Afraid for yourself. But know this. You are not alone.
I blinked at him several times.
What do you mean? I mean that I'm not a part of your own subconscious, son. I'm me. I'm real.
No offense, but of course the dream version of you would say that, I said.
He smiled. Is that what your heart tells you I am? A dreamed shadow of memory?
I stared at him for a minute and then shook my head.
It can't be you. You're dead.
He stood up, walked around the fire, then dropped to one knee beside me. He put his hand on my shoulder.
Yes, I'm dead. But that doesn't mean that I'm not here. It doesn't mean that I don't love you, boy.
The light of the fire blurred in front of my eyes, and a horrible pang went through my chest.
Dad?
His hand squeezed tighter.
I'm here.
I don't understand it, I said.
Why am I so afraid?
Because you've got more to lose than you ever have before, he said. Your brother, your friends. You've opened yourself up to them, loved them. You can't bear the thought of someone taking them away from you.
It's getting to be too much, I said.
My voice shook.
I just keep getting more wounded and tired. They just keep coming at me. I'm not some kind of superhero. I'm just me. And I didn't want any of this. I don't want to die.
He put his other hand on my shoulder and faced me intently. I met his eyes while he spoke.
That fear is natural, but it is also a weakness, a path of attack for what would prey upon your mind. You must learn to control it.
How? I whispered. No one can tell you that, he said. Not me, not an angel, and not a fallen angel. You are the product of your own choices, Harry, and nothing can change that. Don't let anyone or anything tell you otherwise.
But my choices haven't always been very good, I said.
Whose have? He asked. He smiled at me and rose. I'm sorry, son, but I have to go.
Wait,
I said. He put his hand on my head, and for that brief second I was a child again, tired and small and utterly certain of my father's strength.
My boy, there's so much still ahead of you.
So much? I whispered.
Pain, joy, love, death, heartache, terrible waters, despair, hope. I wish I could have been with you longer. I wish I could have helped you prepare for it.
For what?
I asked him.
Shh, he said.
Sleep. I'll keep the fire lit until morning. And darkness and deep, silent, blissfully restful night swallowed me whole.
Chapter 12. The next morning my brain was throbbing with far too many thoughts and worries to allow for any productive thinking. I couldn't afford that. Until I knew exactly what was going on and how to stop it, the most important weapon in my arsenal was reason. I needed to clear my head. I got my running clothes on as quietly as I could, but as tired as Butters looked, I could probably have decked myself in a full suit of Renaissance plate armor without waking him. I took Mouse on his morning walk, filled up a plastic sports bottle with cold water, and headed for the door. Thomas stood waiting for me at the SUV, dressed as I was in shorts and a t-shirt. Only he made it look casually chic, whereas I looked like I bought my wardrobe at garage sales.
Where's the Beetle? He asked.
Shop, I said. Someone beat it up.
Why?
Not sure yet, I said. Feel like a run?
Why? He asked.
My head's full. Need to move.
Thomas nodded in understanding.
Where?
Beach.
Sure, he said. He hooked a thumb at the SUV.
What's with the battleship?
Billy and Georgia loaned it to me.
That was nice of them.
Nice and stupid. It won't last long with me driving it.
I sighed. But I need the wheels.
Come on. It's after dawn, but I still don't want to leave Butters alone for long.
He nodded and we got into the SUV.
You want to tell me what's going on?
God, not until I can blow off some steam running.
I hear you, he said, and we remained silent all the way to the beach. North Avenue Beach is one of the most popular spots in town in the summer. On a cloudy morning at the end of October, though, not many folk were about. There were two other cars in the parking lot, probably belonging to the two other joggers moving steadily on the running trail. I parked the SUV, and Thomas and I got out. I spent a couple of minutes stretching, though it probably wasn't as thorough as it should have been. Thomas just leaned against the SUV, watching me without comment. From what I've seen, vampires don't seem to have a real big problem with pulled muscles. I nodded to him, and we both hit the running trail, starting off at the slowest jog I could manage. I ran like that for maybe 10 minutes before I felt warm enough to pick up the pace. Thomas matched me the whole time, his eyes half-closed and distant. My breathing hit a comfortable stride, hard but not labored. Thomas didn't breathe hard at first either, but my legs are a lot longer than his, and I developed a taste for running as exercise over the past few years. I shifted into a higher gear and finally made him start working to keep up with me. We ran down the beach, past the beach house, a large structure built to resemble the top few decks of an old riverboat, giving the impression that the vessel had sunk into the sand of the beach. At the far end of the beach, we would turn and come back. We went all the way down and back 3 times before I slowed the pace a little and said,
"So, you want to hear what's going on?"
"Yeah," he said.
"Okay."
There was no one nearby, and by now the sun had risen enough to touch the top of the Chicago skyline behind me. Mavra couldn't have been listening in herself, and it was unlikely any mortal accomplice could either. It was as close to ideal privacy as I was likely to get. I started with the arrival of Mavra's package and told Thomas of the events of the entire evening.
"You know what we should do?" Thomas asked when I was finished. "We should kill Mavra. We could make it a family project."
"No," I said. "If we take her out, Murphy will be the one to suffer for it."
"Yeah, yeah," Thomas said. "I'm pretty sure I know what Murphy would have to say about that."
"I don't want it to come to that," I said. "Besides, whatever this word of Kemmler is, there are some seriously nasty people after it. It's probably a good idea to make sure they don't get it."
"Right," Thomas said. "So you keep it away from the nasty people so you can give it to the nasty vampire."
"Not if I can help it," I said.
"So Murphy gets burned anyway?" he asked.
I narrowed my eyes.
"Not if I can help it." "How are you going to manage that?"
"I'm working on it," I said. "The first step is to find the word of Kemmler, or the whole thing is a bust."
"How do you do that?"
"The map," I said. "I don't think these guys are running around working the major black magic for no reason. I need to check out where they've been and figure out what they're doing."
"What about Butters?" Thomas asked.
"For now, we keep him behind my wards. I don't know why Gravain wanted him, and until I figure it out, he's got to keep his head down."
"I doubt Gravain was looking for a polka aficionado," Thomas said.
"I know. It's got something to do with one of the bodies at the morgue."
"So why not go there?" Thomas asked.
"Because the guard was killed there. There's blood all over the place. Maybe the guard's body. And God only knows what Gravain did to the place after we left. The cops will have it locked down hard by now, and they'll definitely want to have a nice long talk with anyone who might have been there. I can't afford to spin my wheels in an interrogation room right now. Neither can Butters."
"So ask Murphy to look around," Thomas said.
I ground my teeth together for a few steps.
"I can't. Murphy's on vacation."
"Oh," he said. "I'm watering her plants."
"Right.
While she's in Hawaii."
"Uh-huh," he said.
With Kincaid. Thomas stopped running. I didn't. He caught up to me 100 yards later.
Well, that's a bitch,
I grunted. I think she wanted me to tell her not to go, I said. I think that's why she came to see me.
So why didn't you? He asked.
Didn't realize it until it was too late. Besides, she's not my girlfriend, or anything. Not my place to tell her who she should see. I shook my head. Besides, I mean, if it was going to be right with Murphy, it would have been right before now, right? If we got all involved and it didn't work out, it would really screw things up for me. I mean, most of my living comes from jobs for SI.
That's real reasonable and mature, Harry, Thomas said.
It's smarter not to try to complicate things. Thomas frowned at me for a moment. Then he said,
You're serious, aren't you?
I shrugged.
I guess so, yeah.
Little brother, he said. I simply cannot get over how stupid you are at times.
Stupid? You just told me it was reasonable.
Your excuses are, Thomas said. But love isn't.
We're not in love.
Never gonna be, Thomas said, if you keep being all logical about it.
Like you're the one to talk.
Thomas's shoes hit the trail a little more sharply. I know what it's like to lose it. Don't be an idiot, Harry. Don't lose it like I did.
I can't lose what I haven't ever had.
You have a chance, he said, a snarl in his words, and I had the sudden sense that he had come precariously close to violent action. And that's more than I've got. I didn't push him. We got to the end of the trail and moved off it, slowing to walk down the beach, winding down. Thomas, I said, what's wrong with you today, man?
I'm hungry, he said, his voice a low growl.
We can hit a McDonald's or something on the way home, I suggested. He bared his teeth.
Not that kind of hunger.
Oh. We walked a while more, and I said, But you fed just yesterday. He laughed, a short and bitter sound.
Fed? No. That woman, that wasn't anything.
She looked like she'd just run a marathon. You took from her.
I took. He spat the words. But there's no substance to it. I didn't take deeply from her. Not from anyone anymore. Not since Justine.
But food is food, right? I said.
No, he said. It isn't.
Why?
It isn't like that.
Then what is it like?
There's no point in telling you, he said.
Why not?
You couldn't understand, he said.
Not if you don't tell me, dolt, I said. Thomas, I'm your brother. I want to understand you. I stopped and put my hand on his shoulder, shoving him just hard enough to make him turn to face me. Look, I know it's not working out the way we hoped, but damn it, if you just go storming off every time you get upset about something, if you don't give me the chance to understand you, we're never going to get anywhere. He closed his eyes, frustration evident on his face. He started walking down the beach, just at the edge of what passed for surf in Lake Michigan. I kept pace. He walked all the way down the beach, then stopped abruptly and said, Race me back. Beat me there, and I'll tell you. I blinked. What kind of kindergarten crap is that? His gray eyes flashed with anger.
You want to know what it's like? Beat me down the beach.
Of all the ridiculous, immature nonsense, I said. Then I hooked a foot behind Thomas's calf, shoved him down to the sand, and took off down the beach at a dead sprint. There's an almost primal joy in the sheer motion and power of running a race. Children run everywhere for a reason. It's fun. Grown-ups can forget that sometimes. I stretched out my legs, still loose from the longer jog, and even though I was running across sand, the thrill of each stride filled my thoughts. Behind me, Thomas spat out a curse and scrambled to his feet, setting out after me. We ran through the gray light. The morning had dawned cold, and even at the lakeside the air was pretty dry. Thomas got ahead of me for a couple of steps, looked back, and kicked his heel, flinging sand in my face and eyes. I inhaled some.